From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain, sitting in for Terry Gross. Ever since Aristotle, we've been trying to figure out why the world is the way it is. Now particle physicists think they're closer than ever to the ultimate answer. On today's Fresh Air, Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg talks about the quest for a final theory, a theory that could have effects beyond the world of science. Also, teaching the developmentally disabled about sexuality. We talk with Betty Pendler, who conducts sexuality workshops for parents of mentally retarded children. Pendler's work grew out of concern for her own daughter, who has Down syndrome. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews two new movies, The Vanishing and Summersby. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney met with President Clinton today. The two stressed their commitment to free trade and their desire to include Mexico in the agreement. Mulroney warned, however, against protectionist sentiment in the U.S. Congress. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Canadian Prime Minister is the first foreign leader Mr. Clinton has met with since taking office. He promised he would do so when he met as the president-elect with Mexican leader Carlos Salinas. All three leaders are working for the eventual end to trade barriers in North America. Mulroney said today that the United States and Canada already enjoy a productive trade relationship, but that from time to time leaders must intervene to preserve their nation's interests. Mulroney said he had high hopes for the new president.
He was selling the free trade agreement when he was governor of Arkansas, throughout the United States. And so I'm very encouraged by his attitudes and his record.
Along with free trade, the two leaders must iron out differences over several natural resource issues involving salmon fishing rights and the environmental impact of mining. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Businesses in Zaire are reportedly beginning to accept new banknotes that were issued by the government of President Mobutu Sese Seko. Critics have charged that the new banknotes were made virtually worthless by Zaire's hyperinflation. Zairean soldiers were paid in the new currency, and they rioted when shopkeepers refused to accept their money. President Mobutu's opponents say that at least 1,000 people were killed in the riots. The decision to accept the currency was made yesterday by European, American, and other business leaders in Zaire. The decision was seen as a victory for Mobutu, who's resisting the transitional government that was set up to ease him from power. A French court ruled today that a former prime minister can't be tried over his role in the distribution of blood tainted by the AIDS virus. Between 1982 and 1985, nearly 1,200 hemophiliacs receiving the transfusions were infected with the AIDS virus, and 200 have died. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The judges ruled that too much time has passed to try former Prime Minister Laurent Fabius on a charge of non-assistance to a person in danger. But legal experts say he could be tried on charges of homicide or fraud. Last year, three top health officials were convicted of fraud for knowingly distributing tainted blood. Fabius was charged along with a former health minister and a former minister for social affairs. They can only be tried by a parliamentary court because the scandal took place while they were in office. Fabius says he's innocent but wants to be tried to clear his name. But a trial would badly damage the socialists. Already, they're highly unpopular, and legislative elections are scheduled for next month. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 24 points today. This is NPR News. President Clinton denied today that his administration is considering canceling two of the nation's largest scientific projects, the space station and the superconducting supercollider. Earlier today, wire service reports quoted congressional sources as saying that the two costly and controversial projects are considered prime targets for budget cuts. The space station is expected to cost about $30 billion, and the Super Collider, already under construction in Texas, is budgeted at $8.2 billion. The Super Collider is a device for the study of subatomic particles. The project was killed last year by the House, but later revived by the Senate. The space station project has also come under strong criticism and has had to undergo at least one major redesign. Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy has promised complete overhaul of U.S. meat inspection practices. The move comes after an outbreak of food poisoning linked to Jack in the Box hamburgers in the state of Washington. NPR's Joe Palca has a report.
As a result of the outbreak, at least one child has died and more than a dozen are hospitalized. The hamburger meat had passed USDA inspection. Agriculture Secretary Espy told a Senate subcommittee that the government would never be able to guarantee that raw meat would be 100% free of harmful bacteria. But he said the government could do a better job of enforcing its current inspection standards. He also promised to bring modern technologies to the Food Inspection Service. For the time being, Espy said the only way to be sure that meat is safe is to cook it thoroughly. At today's subcommittee hearing, Jack in the Box officials acknowledged that, while they had been meeting federal standards, they had not been routinely cooking meat to 155 degrees, a temperature that would have made the tainted hamburgers safe to eat. I'm Joe Palca, reporting.
Writer and director Joseph Mankiewicz died today of heart failure. He was 83. Mankiewicz won Academy Awards for both writing and direction on two movies. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. It's not easy to talk about particle physics on the radio. It's about the world around us we can't see. Protons, neutrons, quarks, leptons. But some of the most exciting research today is in physics, in the search for the fundamental laws of nature. Steven Weinberg is one of the physicists in the forefront of that search. He received the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1979 and the National Medal of Science in 1991. Weinberg is also one of those rare scientists who's able to explain what he does to the rest of us. His book on the Big Bang Theory, The First 3 Minutes, was a bestseller. His new book is called Dreams of a Final Theory, The Search for the Fundamental Laws of Nature. Weinberg teaches at the University of Texas, not far from the controversial and as yet uncompleted supercollider, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. I asked Steven Weinberg what questions he's trying to answer in this search for a final theory.
Well, there's really only one question. That is, why are things the way they are? Why is the world the way it is? Of course, that question takes a vast number of forms. You can ask why grass is green, or why the sky is blue, or why the stars shine. And when you ask those many, many questions, you get answers in terms of a lot of separate sciences developed in the 18th, 19th century, like optics and chemistry. Then if, like an unpleasant child, you ask, well, why is that true? You get an answer, again, in terms of deeper truths, things we learned about in this century, the principles of quantum mechanics, the basic principles that govern the way particles like the electron and the photon and so on interact with each other. And then you can ask, why is that true? And again, the answer is simpler. At a deeper level, you get an answer in terms of a fairly coherent, unified theory called the Standard Model of Elementary Particles. And that provides an answer to almost all of these questions, at least where historical accidents don't play a role. And now the big thing we want to answer is, why is the standard model the way it is? It's not the final answer. It has a lot of arbitrary features and some things just slapped together to make it agree with experiment. It doesn't include gravity, which is certainly a big missing element. And what we want to do now is ask, why is it, and why is our theory of gravity what it is?
Well, how do you know that there is this final theory, a theory that will explain everything? And doesn't every explanation require a further explanation and new theories?
Well, so far that's certainly been true. You could have said in the 19th century that no matter how far north you go, there's always lots of sea and ice left further to the north. And perhaps you might imagine that explorers would have concluded that they would never reach the North Pole. But, you know, they did reach the North Pole. These searches sometimes do come to an end. We don't know for sure that there's a final theory. But it's hard for me to imagine that this process by which our description of nature steadily over the years becomes simpler and more unified could go on forever. I mean, after all, how simple and unified can things get? I don't know, of course, with any confidence that the next step will take us all the way to the final theory. That would be rash to say, but I'm pretty confident that there is a final theory.
How is the work on the superconducting supercollider tied with this quest for the fundamental laws of nature?
We in elementary particle physics have made a great success in recent decades, but now we're paying the price of that success. For the last 15 years, we've been finding that experiments simply go on confirming our existing understanding, the standard model of elementary particles. In order to break out of the impasse, we have to do experiments at a higher level of energy. We know what energy has to be reached because we know from the standard model that there are going to be new phenomena discovered when we can make a trillion volts available for producing new elementary particles. In order to do that, you have to collide particles called protons together with energies of 20 trillion volts each, because much of the energy goes into just recoil of garbage inside the proton. And so we have fastened on this goal of producing collisions between protons at energies of 20 trillion volts. The supercollider is what we need to accelerate particles to those energies.
Well, let me just interrupt you here and just ask a very practical question. In talking about the supercollider, then, you're really talking about a circular track that's how many miles?
Well, that's right. It's an oval track, 54 miles around, comparable to the Washington Beltway. It's underground, deep underground in the chalk that underlays Ellis County, Texas. Inside the tunnel, there will be two tubes, vacuum tubes, in which will circulate beams of particles called protons. These protons will go round and round in the two tubes in opposite directions, millions of times around the track, being gradually accelerated to very, very close to the speed of light until they have an energy about 20,000 times the energy of a proton just sitting at rest. That's an energy of 20 trillion volts. When they reach that energy, the beams will be steered so that they collide with each other. And at several points around the ring, there'll be very large detectors and teams of experimental physicists waiting to see what happens when the protons collide.
And what do you expect will happen?
Well, the protons will collide with each other while the experiments are running about 100 million times a second, and most of those collisions won't be interesting. There will be computers watching the output of the detectors, waiting for an occasional, perhaps one in a million, interesting event. An interesting event will be an event in which this energy of a trillion volts appears in the form of a new kind of elementary particle. There are various kinds of new particles that we've been speculating about, and we know that some of them have to exist because something has to be added to the standard model to make it make sense. And what we want to see is which of these many theoretically conjectured particles actually turns out to come out of these experiments.
Let me ask you a political question about the super collider. There's been a debate both in Congress and also within the field of science about this wrestling match, I guess, between big science and little science. Big science being projects like the superconducting super collider. Scientists slaving away in small science often feel that these big projects gobble up money that could support their projects. Where do you come down in this whole argument about the fight between big and little science?
I get a rash when people start talking about big science and little science.
Are you getting one now?
Well, I'm afraid so. Really, the big distinctions between good science and bad science. I'm not what you might call a big scientist. I work at my desk with pencil and paper. I work with a group of three or four other theoretical physicists and a number of postdocs and graduate students. We have a research contract of $100,000 or so a year. We're not anyone's definition of big science. But our work cannot proceed without the data from very large facilities like the superconducting supercollider. Some of the data we get come from laboratory tabletop experiments, experiments in nuclear beta decay and other things, but that's not enough. We need the information from these very large facilities. We're perishing from want of it. What we have to ask is not, is it a big project or a small project, but how badly do we need the information? What really bothers me is lumping the supercollider together with other projects which are even larger, like the space station, which are not scientific projects at all. Journalists love to do this, and they regularly say large science projects like the supercollider and the space station. Well, the space station may or may not be valuable depending on what sort of technology you want to learn or depending on how philosophically committed you are to getting men into space, men and women into space. But it's not a project that's going to teach us anything much about nature.
How then do you differentiate between what good and bad science is? And how do you determine whether a particular project is going to reap benefits when so much of what science is doing is asking difficult questions?
Well, we do scientific work for a number of different reasons. Some of it is done for practical, immediate purposes, finding a cure for a disease or developing a new kind of electronics for the computer industry. And that's valuable and often very exciting and certainly worth doing. Then there are other things that scientists do because the phenomena are so entrancing that they just can't resist it. For example, the study of certain kinds of phase transitions, which aren't of any great technological importance, but allow beautiful theories to be developed. That's also good science. And sometimes it turns out to have important technological applications. Then there's a third kind, this kind that's really special to elementary particle physics and I suppose to cosmology also, which I see as fulfilling a historical imperative of finding those ultimate principles that lie at the root of everything and that have no explanation in terms of deeper principles. That's one of the several motives for doing science. But I think it's a good motive. And in doing it, we have to ask, is what we're doing really directed at that goal, or are we just having fun clashing particles together? I think what we're doing is directed toward that goal. We're not studying these collisions of elementary particles because we find the particles so interesting in themselves. You know, if you've seen one proton, you've seen them all. They in themselves are not interesting the way that people are interesting. In fact, the fact that every proton is like every other proton shows how simple they are, and that simplicity is a clue that they have something to do with the laws of nature at a rather deep level.
My guest on Fresh Air today is Steven Weinberg. He's a physicist and in 1979 received the Nobel Prize for Physics. He's also the author of a new book called Dreams of a Final Theory. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is physicist Steven Weinberg. Well, let me get back to the supercollider. Let's say the supercollider is built and is funded and the project is underway. And after 10 years, you haven't found that collision that you're looking for. How do you know whether to keep going another 10 years? How do you know if you're on the right or wrong track?
Well, if the supercollider is funded and is finished, and then experiments are funded and performed, we're really quite confident that we will be seeing new physics at the energies that can be reached at the supercollider. That's why it was designed to have the capabilities it has. That isn't always true with new accelerators. Sometimes you build them just because you feel if you increase the energy available by a factor of 10, something new is bound to turn up. That's usually been true. But the supercollider represents one of those rare examples where we have a target in mind that we know we can reach.
How would you say that would change a everyday person's everyday life?
Well, you know, if an article appears in the Physical Review announcing the discovery of a superparticle or of a Higgs boson or of a technopion, I don't think that the public's life is going to be immediately changed. I'm proud of my field, but I'm not crazy. But I do think that discoveries at the frontiers of science have an effect not only in producing new technologies, although that's always been true in the past, but in changing our culture. You know, Isaac Newton's theory of gravity originally was understood only by a very small number of people. Voltaire had to translate Newton's ideas for the general educated public of the continent. But nevertheless, the Newtonian picture of the world, a world governed by impersonal mathematical laws, percolated through into the general consciousness. And according to the British historian Hugh Trevor Roper, it was that scientific revolution, which Newton's theory was the central element, that eventually led people in Europe and America to stop burning witches. People in general learned that we live in a world governed by understandable laws. And the process of science has all been in that direction. Darwin's theory of evolution certainly had a profound effect on the way that people look at life and the meaning of it. I think that the discovery of a final theory will be, in a way, a capstone of that historical development. It will show what kind of a world we live in, what kind of rules this world is governed by.
Where do you think scientific investigation bumps heads with religious ideas? And certainly looking at this idea of the final theory gets you into the realm of God. And you talk about Stephen Hawking. He talks about the universe in terms of the mind of God. Do you feel comfortable with that language as a physicist?
I think this is a very personal matter, and I don't have any particular credentials to talk about it, but since you've asked, I'll answer. I am bothered by Stephen Hawking or even Albert Einstein using the word God rather loosely. Einstein said that by God he didn't mean a being that cared about us, that cared about good or evil. He meant some abstract principle of order and harmony. Well, you know, you can use the word that way, but it seems to me that does violence to the meaning the word has had over the centuries. Generally speaking, people have understood by, quote, God, unquote, to mean some caring God, an interested God that cares about us and that has established standards of good or evil. You can use the word any way you like, but it seems to me that's the way to use it that makes it an interesting question. If by the word God you mean just a principle of abstract harmony and order, then why use the word, except perhaps to avoid the accusation that you have no God? With that meaning of the word God, a caring, interested God, I think you can ask, do we expect to find signs of such a God in the final laws of nature when we have the Book of Rules? And, of course, I don't know because we haven't got the final laws of nature yet, but everything I know about the historical development of science suggests to me the opposite, that as we go deeper and deeper in our understanding of nature, we find that it seems more and more cold and impersonal.
Let me ask you about discovery. And in your book, you talk about symmetry and the simplicity of an idea, talking about math and logical explanations. You also say that a theory is beautiful. I mean, that in a sense, you know you're on the right track when it feels beautiful. Can you describe what you mean by that?
It's difficult. It's difficult to say what you mean by a beautiful painting or a beautiful piece of music, and it's not easy to say what you mean by a beautiful theory. But I think it's something like the beauty of a tight, highly structured art form like a sonata or a sonnet. You know, when you hear a classical sonata, you have the feeling that no note could be changed, that you would not want to rewrite a single bar of the music. Similarly, with a poem like a sonnet that has a definite structure, you wouldn't want to change a word in a Shakespearean sonnet. Physical theories have that kind of beauty of a sonnet or a sonata. When they're beautiful, I think they're beautiful because there's nothing in them that you could imagine to be different. That's never entirely true. If that was completely true, I guess we would be at the final theory. But when you have a theory like general relativity, for example, Einstein said about it that the wonderful thing about it was that it couldn't be changed. You couldn't fool around with it and get a different theory that would make any sense at all.
Well, is that the feeling that you get, that you're on the right path? You talk about a feeling of inevitability.
That's right. We are looking for theories that give us that sense of inevitability. The Standard Model of Elementary Particles is a long step in that direction compared to the mishmash of miscellaneous facts that we physicists had to learn when I was a graduate student. But it's not all the way. There are elements in the Standard Model which are quite arbitrary and are just put in to make the theory agree with experiment. And it's those arbitrary and hence ugly things that make us sure it's not the final answer.
You mentioned this earlier as we were talking, and my question is how, if this theory that you're looking for is in the end a simple idea, looking at nature, how could a simple idea give birth to so much complexity?
Oh, well, of course, it's hard just looking at the world as it is to imagine that there could be anything simple underlying it. But, you know, that's the way science has progressed. Newton developed a very simple theory, an inverse square law and certain equations describing motion that explained the motions of all the planets and even the fall of apples and the rise and fall of the tides here on Earth. Now we have a theory, quantum mechanics, that in principle allows us to explain all of the chemistry of all the fantastic variety of substances that can be produced in the laboratory or naturally found on Earth. Nature, beneath its apparent complexity, is really remarkably simple. It isn't a new idea. Plato, and even before Plato, Greek philosophers like Parmenides speculated that the apparent complexity of nature was just an appearance, that beneath it there was great simplicity and perfection. We're proceeding very much in that Platonic direction, finding simplicity beneath the apparent complexity of things, but not the way Plato did, not by just talking about it and thinking about it, but by thinking about it and then testing our ideas with experiments, by doing experiments which suggest new ideas. And out of this fusion of experiment and theory, which really I think goes back to Galileo, we find simplicity emerging.
Steven Weinberg, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Steven Weinberg is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist and the author of Dreams of a Final Theory. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. Recently, four high school boys were charged with sexually assaulting a 17-year-old retarded girl in New Jersey. The case is now on trial, and it underscores a concern that many parents have about their developmentally disabled children. What should you teach your child about sex? And how much can your child understand? Coming up, we talk with Betty Pendler. She teaches a sexuality workshop for parents of the developmentally disabled. Pendler's work grew out of concerns for her own daughter. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews two new movies that are remakes, The Vanishing and Summersby. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. New York Federal Court Judge Kimba Wood has taken her name out of consideration for U.S. Attorney General. In a statement, Wood said that she had hired a babysitter for her son in March of 1986, whose visa had expired. Wood added that this was prior to enactment of the Immigration Reform and Control Act. Wood said at that time it was lawful to employ aliens whose visa had expired as long as all required taxes and forms were filed. She says that while her acts were lawful, the babysitter was not legally in the country until she obtained legal residence in December of 1987. She adds that while she has acted legally, in the current political environment to proceed with her nomination would not be appropriate. President Clinton and Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney said today, after a working lunch at the White House, that they had a very good beginning. The two leaders said they vowed to make trade between the two countries a top priority. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The two leaders emphasized their commitment to the trade pact and a willingness to work together on side agreements with Mexico concerning the environment and labor. But it isn't a two-way deal, Mr. Clinton said. It's a three-way deal. All three leaders aim to dissolve trade barriers within North America, creating the largest trade bloc in the world. Mulroney hinted that he's concerned about members of the U.S. Congress who he says are sounding protectionist alarms. The legislatures of all three countries have yet to ratify the agreement. Anytime protectionism takes hold, it's bad for prosperity, Mulroney said today. The president's a free trader, and so am I. Mr. Clinton reassured Canadians today, saying that the opportunities between the two countries overwhelm the problems. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
President Clinton and his top advisors have indicated their disappointment that Haiti's military rules have again been rebuffed UN efforts to restore democracy. The Clinton administration has threatened tighter sanctions. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
UN Special Envoy Dante Caputo left Haiti yesterday without an agreement to deploy hundreds of human rights monitors throughout the nation. Haitian military leaders agreed to the monitors last month, but imposed unacceptable conditions this week. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said it's premature to write off efforts to send in the monitors. The UN and OAS will study Haitian counterproposals. But Boucher warned, we won't tolerate interminable delays. President Clinton said today he's doing his best to restore democracy to Haiti.
We will continue to push ahead, either on the course we're now on, or if that fails, on a more vigorous course toward that end.
A more vigorous course could well mean tighter sanctions against Haiti. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today that will be one of the things we'll be considering. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 24 points to close at a new high of 3,442. This is NPR News. Government officials in Germany say that unemployment is now at its highest point since unification, rising in the western part of the nation to 8.3%. In eastern Germany, unemployment is now at 15.1% of the workforce, compared to 13.5% in December. Nearly 3.5 million people in Germany cannot find jobs. The government expects a loss of 450,000 more jobs this year. Senate investigators concluded today that the CIA and Justice Department failed to provide prosecutors with significant information in the case of an Atlanta bank manager making $4 billion in unauthorized loans. But the investigators concluded the information was withheld because of ineptitude. NPR's Ann Garrels has more on the story.
The investigation was launched after Democrats accused the Bush administration of deliberately botching the case in order to cover up its support for Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein before he invaded Kuwait. The Justice Department charged the Atlanta manager of the Banca Nazionale di Lavoro, or BNL, with trying to defraud the bank of $4 billion in loans to Iraq. The report doesn't find any evidence the CIA knew about the BNL loans before the FBI raided the bank in 1989. But after that, the CIA did conclude Italian officials back in Rome were aware of the loans. According to the Senate report, the CIA's failure to provide this information could have affected the case. When the CIA finally supplied the material, the Justice Department failed to pass it on to the pertinent prosecutors. The report accuses the CIA and the Justice Department of confusion and bungling, but not deliberate deception. Not everyone on the Senate Intelligence Committee is happy with the report, and there are, yet again, calls for the appointment of an independent prosecutor. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A trial in New Jersey has raised a host of questions about sex and the mentally handicapped. The case involves a 17-year-old mentally retarded girl and four members of the Glen Ridge High School football team. She is charged that they sexually assaulted her in March 1989 when they took her to a basement with the promise of a date with one of them. There she performed various sex acts and was sodomized with a baseball bat and a broomstick. The students have claimed that she consented to the sex. The defense has just rested its case. For the past 10 years, Lisa Pendler, who is mentally handicapped, has lived in an adult group home 7 blocks from her mother's Manhattan apartment. Lisa is employed by a sheltered workshop. Lisa's mother, Betty Pendler, has been an outspoken proponent of sex education for the developmentally disabled, talking with other parents and professionals about the need to speak openly about sex. We called Betty at her home to talk about how she has prepared Lisa for independent living. I asked her to tell us about her daughter.
Lisa has Down syndrome, and she has all the facial characteristics that people with Down syndrome have, but she has a very delightful personality. I know that I object to the stereotypes when people say, oh, all Down syndrome is so cute and so lovable. That always isn't necessarily true. They all have their distinct personalities. She happens to be extremely social and very pleasant. Part of the reason she's so social is because very early on in life, I determined to, my husband and I decided that we were not going to place her, that we were going to keep her at home and we were going to treat her as normally as possible and keep her in the outside world.
Now, she lives in a group home, is that right?
She's been living in a group home now for 10 years.
How far is that home from your home?
Quite close. It's only 7 blocks. And the truth is, though, I did engender, you know, I do speak to the parents that it's so vital for us to make sure that our children are independent and give them what we call the dignity of risk. You see, the parents, I think, out of what I call a selfish form of love, more to allay their own anxiety, are afraid to let their children take chances without realizing that they're denying the opportunities to grow. And it was very hard for me. I taught Lisa how to travel in the New York subways. She can't do it independently, but once she's shown, like 2 or 3 times, then she can get there on her own.
Do you worry about her then?
And I certainly do. I worry about her, but then I weigh what's more important. Is it her good or my good? And I think it's one more burden of being a parent of a child who's handicapped. We have to worry much more about them than we do about the normal child.
When did you think it was time to talk to Lisa about sex?
Well, actually, I felt that one should talk about sex at a very early age. And when one thinks about sex, you know, sex begins when you hold a child, you know, in your lap, and you begin to tickle him and you give him tactile experiences. And I'm kind of a very feeling person. So I feel that when you're hugging and you're kissing and things like that, I did have to begin to talk to her about sex because many Down children are extremely affectionate and they go around kissing everybody. So one of the things that parents have to do for children who are developmentally disabled, maybe particularly with Downs, is constantly repeat And I think a lot of parents just assume that they don't understand, but with enough repetition, they do understand. Lisa used to kiss the mailman. She used to kiss the people on the street as I walked, and the grocery boy. And I would constantly tell her that I know you like people, but you mustn't kiss them. You only kiss people who are close to you, like your parents and your relatives and your friends. And I kept repeating it. And whenever she did start to kiss people, I would say, it's nice to kiss when you love people, but you don't love everybody in the street.
You know, we're told that most parents actually don't talk to their children about sex. Do you think that parents of the developmentally disabled have a special obligation to talk to their children about sex?
Well, I maintain that they do. I feel very strong that they do. I think that most parents don't, for a variety of reasons. They are so consumed by their fears and anxieties. And by the way, I want to validate the fears and the anxieties because they're real. Now, Winifred Kempton is a very, very well-known expert in the field of sexuality. She worked for Planned Parenthood, as a matter of fact, Pennsylvania for many years. And she always says that parents very rarely ask, what is a child thinking or feeling? Because they're so overwhelmed by their fears and anxieties. And very often, parents don't even acknowledge that their child is going to grow up. You know, unfortunately, too many parents infantilize the children. They feel, well, they're never going to reach an age of independence. And so they're certainly not going to talk about sex. But I began very early using the correct terminology. I think that's very important. A lot of parents are afraid to use the word penis and vagina. As a matter of fact, a lot of mothers are too embarrassed. And even to this day, some mothers with daughters almost as old as Lisa still use the infantile words.
Let me ask you, since you're talking about words, were you worried that if you discussed sex with your daughter, that she would think you were giving her permission?
Yes, that's what all of the parents say, because when I go around and part of my talk to parents when I give these parent workshops is to try to assure them that giving them information will not create sexual feelings. What they have to know is those feelings are there, and that the truth of the matter is, and experts who write in the field of sexuality claim that the more knowledge you have, the more protected you are. And they claim that very often those who are abused or exploited is because they don't know anything about it. And when Lisa did begin to travel, I didn't want to frighten her. And I used to tell her that if any man comes near her and tries to touch her vagina, she should scream. I try to assure her that that probably won't happen. But if it does happen, she should make sure that she doesn't allow him. So I did talk about that very, very early on.
Do you want her to have a sex life?
Well, actually, I do. And interestingly enough, she knows that I do a lot of talking on this subject. She'd give me a little bit more credibility if she did. And I have spoken to her quite freely because she does have a boyfriend. And they have had she's had a lot of sexuality training. See, my contention is that I think that the parents must encourage having sex training. She's had all kinds of videotapes and courses in sexuality, and they have excellent tools. You know, they have anatomical figures and all kinds of very explicit videos on the subject, and especially now with AIDS, they've got a wonderful explicit video about condoms. And in her first group home, there was. The woman she roomed with was having sex with a young man. And so I did say to Lisa, well, you know, whenever you're ready, and I didn't want to discourage her, I said, that would be all right. I said, but you have to make sure that you talk to the counselor. And she said, I know. If I want to, I have to have birth control. So I think that they've got it drummed into them.
So she's aware of birth control. Does she know about sexually transmitted diseases?
Yes, she does now, definitely, because both even in the public schools, they began this kind of training. And now all of the agencies are doing intensive training with the advent of AIDS.
Betty Pendler is my guest. We're talking about sex education and the mentally handicapped. We'll come back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Betty Pendler about her daughter and about her work to prepare the developmentally disabled for adulthood. Tell me a little bit about when you're talking to parents of other developmentally disabled people. What are their concerns? What are their questions? And I'm especially curious if they have a child who is lower functioning than your daughter is.
Yes, that's true. You know, they all bring up that, you know, what you're saying is valid because your daughter understands. Well, I tell them that I think, though, that on a lower level, they can use sexuality training. Sexuality training is also, you know, learning about your bodies, learning about your body parts. And for the lower functioning, there's sometimes the parents are so worried that they're going to expose themselves, and the parents for the lower functioning get very upset about the whole subject of masturbation. They're so afraid that their sons or daughters are going to masturbate inappropriately. And I urge them, you know, not to be embarrassed about it, but that they can learn the same as they learn toileting skills and the same as they learn life skills about how to dress. They can learn social behaviors.
We're talking about the issue of sex, but I think it's part of a larger discussion about how the developmentally disabled can handle independence, can handle the responsibility of independence, can handle making choices. How do you talk about those issues to parents?
I'm so glad that you bring that up, because my big argument to parents is that, you know, we've lived so long with all of the things that they can't do. All along, the doctors have told us that they couldn't do this and they couldn't do that. So we've kind of grown up on a self-fulfilling prophecy, whereas the mothers now of the younger children now get early intervention, and they really have dreams and visions, and they feel that their sons and daughters can do anything. And very early on, they give them what I call the dignity of risks, and they challenge them to do things. And I urge parents that they must prepare their sons and daughters for independence, because one of the reasons I had Lisa move into a group home was because I knew eventually I wouldn't be around, and so she had to learn to be as independent as she possibly could. And that when the mothers say, oh, I'm afraid to let her do this alone, I'm afraid she'll hurt herself, I maintain that she's become dependent upon that child's dependency. She's denying the child the thrill of doing something. Now, Lisa gets a check at the workshop, and most of the mothers take the check and cash it and then give their daughter the corresponding money. I allow Lisa to go to the bank and cash it herself. And people will say, aren't you afraid she's going to be ripped off? And I say, sure I am, but she'll learn. And in fact, she did lose the money once. I don't know whether she was ripped off or whether she lost it. But with enough talking, the next few times, she stood right by the cashier's window and counted it. So if I didn't let her do it and make mistakes, she never would have learned it. I tell the parents that we mustn't be afraid of failure, that they learn by their mistakes.
Now, your daughter's in a group home, and she goes and works at the local association there. How much contact does she have with people who aren't developmentally disabled?
Well, this is what we try. We're trying very, very hard. And now when we talk about inclusion and we talk about communities, we try very hard to get them to go places where they will be with the non-disabled. Now, we tried to have them attend a church and synagogue services so that they would be seen by the other people. And very often it does work. And interestingly enough, Lisa takes a bus to go to the workshop. And one morning Lisa was telling me about, oh, my friend Marcy invited me for brunch. I said, who's Marcy? She said, Marcy's somebody I meet on the bus every morning. And next week she told me Marcy invited her again for brunch. And I said, will you please get Marcy's phone number? And it turns out that Marcy is a young 25-year-old lady who's an architect and takes the same bus that Lisa and the others do. And she kind of got intrigued by Lisa. And Lisa was extremely sociable, so she invited her to her group home. And Marcy said that she really now, about every third week, she visits Lisa, and they go out, and she's invited her to her home and brought her back to her house, taught her how to make brownies with her sister. And then she said, I'm going to go with Lisa to the movies. And I think it's significant that she doesn't say, I'm taking Lisa to the movies. So here and there, a spark of the community comes in to them. But the truth of the matter is there isn't enough. We do try very hard. Years ago, Lisa would go to the Y, and they'd have swimming at 10 o'clock in the morning. Now we're insisting that the developmentally disabled go to the Y the same as everybody else. But the organization does supply extra staff. But we want them to be seen by everybody.
Well, I thank you very much, Betty Pendler, for joining us today and for talking about your daughter and talking about the work that you do. I really appreciate it.
Oh, good. And I hope now the public, one last thing, I hope the public see these as people first. I never like to be introduced as the mother of a retarded daughter. I'm the mother of a daughter who's retarded because she's my daughter first, retarded second.
Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Betty Pendler lives in Manhattan. She talks with parents and professionals about sex education and the developmentally disabled. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about the news today. Linda, I understand that President Clinton has signed the family leave bill.
That's right. And the Democratic administration is calling this the end of gridlock. It's not clear quite yet that that is true. We'll also be talking to some business people who see problems with the family leave bill. Federal Judge Kimba Wood was all but appointed in the newspapers this morning to the post of Attorney General. Apparently, the White House is backing off of that a little bit. Nina Totenberg is on the case. We'll find out what Nina knows. And we have an interview with Radovan Karadzic, who's in New York to negotiate for the Bosnian Serbs.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Here's one of those coincidences that journalists love. The two big movies opening this week are both Hollywood remakes of hit foreign films. Summersby takes the 1982 French film The Return of Martin Guerre and sets it just after the Civil War. The Vanishing comes from the Dutch film of the same name by director George Sluiser, who also directed the remake. Film critic Stephen Schiff examines the results.
You are not Jack Summersby, so why do you keep going on pretending that you are?
How do you know I'm not?
I know because...
How do you know, Laura?
I know because...
How do you know?
I know because I never loved him the way that I love you.
If you've been anywhere near a television set during the last few weeks, you've already been subjected to that scene from Summersby. In fact, if you've been anywhere near a television set, you already know the whole plot, because the ads from Summersby virtually lay it out for you. Ads for The Vanishing haven't been quite as explicit, but the movie itself is. Both of these films are mysteries that work overtime to avoid being mysterious. The original version of The Return of Martin Guerre was based on a true story that took place during the 15th century, the story of a man who one day showed up in a French village claiming to be Martin Guerre, who had left his pregnant child bride there 8 years before. The new guy looked like Martin Guerre, only he was much nicer, much smarter, much more loving. Was he an imposter? The movie was careful to leave the question hanging until the very end. And the desolate medieval setting added to the aura of enigma and superstition. But Summersby tips its hand right from the beginning. Richard Gere, as the man who claims to be Jack Summersby, is a sweetheart from the moment he sets foot in Vine Hill, Tennessee. Mrs. Summersby, played by Jodie Foster, falls hard for him, and pretty soon he's got the whole town growing tobacco, making money. He's even fighting the Ku Klux Klan and helping former slaves get their own land. The movie works as a kind of swoony period romance, partly because Jodie Foster gives an especially touching version of her usual performance, tough and forbidding at first, and then melting and vulnerable as the movie goes on. Gere exudes his characteristic narcissism, but a lot of people may find the whole situation terribly attractive. You land a brand new Mr. Wonderful version of your old husband without having to get rid of the first one and go through all that dating again. I found Summersby faintly ludicrous, especially its contrived ending, and also painfully schematic. I mean, the tobacco flourishes as the Summersby's love flourishes. And then when people get suspicious about Summersby's identity, the tobacco gets a bad case of worms. I suppose that's the filmmaker's way of making sure we don't get confused. And maybe that's the difference between European movies and American ones. The original Return of Martin Guerre was willing to leave us suspended, wondering, grabbing for answers. The original version of The Vanishing was, too. In fact, it was a terrific little thriller, the story of a young man whose girlfriend one day vanishes when they stop at a gas station during a car trip. In the original, we then suddenly cut away from the young man to find ourselves, somewhat confusingly, in the midst of the life of a very peculiar and meticulous stranger. And as it dawns on us that the stranger is preparing to abduct a young girl, the very girl, in fact, whom we've just seen disappear, the squirmy appeal of the mystery grows and grows. In George Schleicher's new version of his film, Jeff Bridges plays the abductor, and we meet him right at the beginning and watch him make his preparations for the kidnapping. By the time Kiefer Sutherland shows up as Jeff Harriman with his girlfriend Diane, we know exactly what's going to happen, and her vanishing is no mystery at all. True, there are still a few creepy scenes, like this one, in which Bridges makes Sutherland an offer he can hardly refuse.
This coffee is drugged. Judging from your size and weight, it will take about 15 minutes to take effect. It will put you out for 40 minutes or so. The same length of time that Diane was out. You must remain unconscious for that period in order for us to move on.
So she's not dead?
Drink.
And afterwards, what?
Drink, and you will experience exactly what she experienced.
In the earlier version, that scene was the prelude to a devastating final chapter. In this version, it's prelude to a series of thuddingly conventional suspense scenes and turnarounds. Director George Schleicher apparently knows more about kidnapping than his characters do. He's abducted his own brainchild and sold it down the river to Hollywood.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Fred Landrell. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Artie Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
For 12 years, America's drug problem has gotten worse, even though the government has spent more to fix it. On the next Fresh Air, we look at solutions for the drug crisis with Mathea Falco, who advised President Clinton during the campaign, and with sociologist Elliot Curry. I'm Artie Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.